Osiris.
Hey, this is Reed Mathis. This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with podcasts and live experiences about artists and topics you love. Check out OsirisPod.com and stay in the loop. Sign up for the newsletter to learn about the newest podcasts and events. Relix Magazine is a media partner of Osiris. For music news, go to Relix.com.
Hello, Road to Now listener. Seems that by being here means that you like to get information by listening to it. You might be listening right now in your car, while you're driving, maybe you're mowing your grass, maybe you're just sitting in a room by yourself staring at a wall. In any case, you're learning by listening. I like to do the same thing, which is why a couple weeks ago, I went looking for a new audiobook company and I came across Libro.fm. Libro.fm is an audiobook company which allows you to purchase your audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers, recommendations for bookstores around the country, and also a playlist curated by The Road to Now featuring our past guests. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobook at the same price as the other audiobook companies, whatever they are, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to, check out recommendations from our podcast featuring guests including Jefferson Cowie, Douglas Brinkley. There's so many of them. You can go check it out. I made the playlist myself, and I'm really proud to do this. The best part about Libro.fm is that you literally are sponsoring your local bookstore. And if you're anything like me, you really like your local bookstore, but sometimes you want audiobooks. Well, here is the solution to the problem. Road to Now listeners can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month. That means for just $15, you can sign up and you'll get 3 months with one free book. And if you're anything like me, you're going to download a giant biography of like Grant or something and listen to it over the course of a month. It's all the same price. $15 a month. How do you get that? All you have to do is go to Libro.fm. That's Libro. Letter F, letter M, and enter the promo code RTN at the top of the page. And they also have gifts. You can buy a gift for somebody if you're looking for that special holiday gift. Give them the gift of knowledge. Just go to Libro.fm, enter the promo code RTN, and we thank you for listening.
I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer. This is The Road
to... Yeah, this is The Road to Now. Yeah, we know. We know. Okay. This is important. Karl Marx, 1859. A contribution to the critique of political economy.
Mm-hmm.
In the social production of their existence, men inevitably enter into definite relations, which are independent of their will, namely relations of production appropriate to a given stage in the development of their material forces of production. The totality of these relations of production constitutes the economic structure of society, the real foundation, on which arises a legal and political superstructure and to which correspond definite forms of social consciousness.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Now, built on this, on many of our listeners, they hear the name Karl Marx, they hear Marxism, they think of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, or China,
they think
or
of communism.
Any number of very bloody and very utopian yet dystopian, but overall tragic and inhumane states.
However, in my class, Historical Methods, we're learning about the Marxist theory of historical methodology.
Right, which is something different.
That has nothing to do with a political form of government.
Well, not nothing to do with, but can be separated from. That's important.
Well, according to my professor, it has nothing to do. It is completely separate from a political form of government.
Right, because the thing about Marx is that he never said, here's what you should do. Like, basically, that was the work of people like Lenin or Mao or other theorists who took Marx's theories and reworked them and put them into their own convenient, maybe not say convenient, but their own worldviews, and then expanded on them to suggest possible conclusions and where you should go. The reality is, though, Marxism does a lot of things that, like, in terms of a lens to see things, it can be useful it can be totally useful to people who are capitalist. In fact, you know, one of the things that happens is every time there's a financial crisis, people go back and start reading Marx more. But you're right, because when you think about historical lenses and methodologies, they allow you to see things in history that you don't, you might not see otherwise. And that's one of the things that Marx was so useful for, because he proposed a narrative. And history is the study of change over time, right?
Correct.
This is one of the things we study. And Marx proposed what he at least touted as a scientific method, like a scientific explanation of the way this goes down. And when you apply it, it might not be perfect, but you can see a lot of things that you might not see. And certainly people in the 19th century weren't looking at when it came to writing history and looking at the way the world worked.
So this is per John Tosh from his textbook, The Pursuit of History. The dangers in this case are familiar enough. Speaking of Marx, Marx's detractors have made such play with some of the less attractive tendencies in his thought that, to all except the fairly restricted number of people who have read Marx himself or academic commentaries on his writings, he is associated with a bleak determinism and an utter cynicism about human nature. On this reading, the central tenets of Marxism go something like this. History is subject to the inexorable control of economic forces, which move all human societies along the road to socialism through the same stages, capitalism being occupied by most of humankind. At all times, material interest has been the mainspring of human behavior, regardless of the motives people have actually professed. Classes represent the collective expression of this self-interest, and all of history is therefore nothing more than the history of class conflict.
It's not that that's not in there. Marx says that the, you know, all history is the story of class conflict. But before we go further, Bob, let me be clear to our listeners when we're talking about this. I am not the world's foremost expert on Marxist philosophy. I am someone who has been practicing history a long time. I am someone who has read a lot of Marx in my life because it's one of those things like I study the history of capitalism. I'm very interested in economic theory. I've read Marx. I've read Adam Smith. I've read Schumpeter. I've read all the great economic theorists. I think there's something beautiful about most of them. So what I'm trying to explain here is the take of someone who's not necessarily digging into Marx himself, but looking at the way Marx has been applied appropriately and inappropriately based on my reading. Whew, that was a mouthful. So anyway, yeah, people see it as dismal. But the reality is, Bob, would you deny the fact that the way that you relate to people and the way that your life works is structured by the way that you earn your income?
Would I deny that the way I interact with people and the way I live my life is structured by my income?
The way that you make your income, the way that you provide for your food, your basic needs, your family's needs, does that not shape the way that you see the world?
I suppose there are ways in which it does. There are also ways in which it doesn't.
Right. But this is...
half true.
This is why it's so complicated, right? Because, Bob, you are an idealist by the definition. Because your worldview is inspired by Christianity.
Right.
And thus you find meaning and value in things outside of the actual economic basis. You base your decisions upon a morality, right?
Right. Right. Yes.
Marx would say that morality that you have is structured entirely upon the economic conditions we live in. It's been made to suit them. That's one of the reasons that Christianity has been so powerful is it's figured out how to accommodate itself to slave societies, to empires, to democracies. And that, in fact, he would probably say that the reason that you believe the Christianity that you believe has to do with the fact that it was adaptable to the economic conditions and allows you to live in a way that you can see it reconciling itself and justifying and legitimizing the way that you do go about your business. He would also say that a lot of this and the kind of the basis of this is that it serves particular interests and it serves particular classes of people. And that's the reason you believe it in its current manifestation. That's why it's so hard for people who have faith to like Marx. But that doesn't mean Marx isn't still useful.
Well, I think there are some theoretical, you know, it's a social theory, right? It is one of many social theories. And in fact, if I am to believe the textbook I'm reading, it's an antiquated social theory at this point. It is no longer in vogue, right? There are still historians working in the Marxist theoretical tradition. There are, I guess, neo-Marxist historians. A lot of labor historians work in a Marxist tradition. I would suspect Jefferson Cowie. I would suspect Lewis Hyman. I would suspect that their work is somewhat based in Marxist theory. And again, I'm not talking about the political, I'm talking about Marxism as an analysis of history.
Right. And using the categories of analysis, right? And that's something that's been expanded. But all right, so let's break this down.
Okay. Can I add one thing?
Yeah. Go ahead.
That may be helpful to our listeners. So when you're thinking about Marx as a category of analysis, you must look at what Marx as a historian came up with, which was his historical epochs. So Marx broke down history into three historical epochs. And again, I'm referring to my textbook here, John Tosh, The Pursuit of History. He, Marx, distinguished three historical epochs down to his own day. Now, we're talking about the 1840s to 1880s, correct?
Yeah, he was born in 1818, and then he died in 1883.
Okay. He distinguished three historical epochs down to his own day, each molded by a progressively more advanced mode of production. These were ancient society, Greece and Rome, feudal society, which emerged after the fall of the Roman Empire, and capitalist, or the modern bourgeoisie.
Right.
Society, which had first come into being in England in the 17th century and had since triumphed elsewhere in Europe. This is interesting to me, Ben, and I'm hoping you can help explain it, particularly as a consequence of the French Revolution. How did bourgeoisie, modern society, how was it impacted by the French Revolution?
So here's how I would explain that. So the old form that Marx talks about being destroyed by capitalism is essentially there's an aristocracy. They're basically legitimacy is based on blood. It's backed up by a narrative that suggests that history has been and will continue to be shaped by God's will. And God's will is that the king be the king. And therefore, power is distributed hereditarily, right? Through the vision that this is God's will. And the people who are not in the aristocracy, the overwhelming masses of them are peasants. Peasants work land for the aristocracy. And they, you know, there's different ways it works, serfdom and things like this, but they have their land. The land does not belong to them, but they are granted the land by the Lord, the landlord, literally. And that person then allows them to produce, you know, for themselves, but then they also owe the landlord and the aristocracy their labor as well. This also involves if there's a war. If you got to go to war. That's a big part. In other words, under this system, you as a subject, not a citizen, but as a subject, you owe the aristocracy, right? Because all of this is God's grace, and you are where you are because you're supposed to be. Your belonging has to do with being a subject of that particular aristocracy. What the French Revolution does, and there's some of this in the American Revolution before, but the French Revolution does it much more powerfully. It unhinges that narrative. They cut the heads off the monarchs. They essentially say, no longer is France defined by monarchs. France is now defined as a nation. And nations are places not where your legitimacy is based upon, you know, someone else's, you know, being subjects of someone else. You now, you're citizens. And the citizenship, the basis of citizenship and the narrative in that story is very different. It's an Enlightenment view. That our rights come not from like through a monarch, but through the creator, right? And that's also important because that's Jefferson as well, who then helped Lafayette write the Declaration of Rights of Men. This idea that there is a natural endowment upon people, right? And Jefferson very specifically says creator because he's not pinpointing who that is, right? But that these are natural, and that in fact the narrative changes under this. The earlier narrative suggested that. If you rebel against the king, you're rebelling against God. To challenge the throne is to challenge the livelihood of your soul eternally. Now, in fact, under this new story that really, as I said, comes forward with the French Revolution, the king is not the guarantor of belonging and of salvation. The king is actually the antithesis of true freedom.
Okay, let's stop right there. This is important. Change, according to Marx, a capitalist system will ultimately become a socialist system. This happens through a dialectic.
Right, the dialectic.
The dialectic, which is a thesis. And then every time you have a thesis, there's automatically an antithesis, which is not necessarily the opposite.
Right.
Right. But the thesis and the antithesis are in conversation with one another, and they form a
synthesis. Right. This is the dialectical materialism. This is the theory, and this is why the notion of conflict is so central to Marx, because it is that there is a dominant form, and that there is something that is in opposition to it. The combination or the conflict between those creates the new conditions in which people live. And to Marx, those conditions are what defines. So once you have with the aristocracy and kind of the Enlightenment ideal setting up, aristocracy is now essentially the opposite of freedom. So this begins to fall. Belonging then, what do you belong to? What's the new story? Before the story was this, I mean, your narrative was the narrative that was given to you through the church, right? And varying interpretations depending on what king you were under and which church was the most, oftentimes most convenient for them in terms of their alliances. But overall, you have that sense of belonging. It's unhinged. So the question becomes, where are we? What's going on? What's the story we have to actually explain what's happening now? And in the 20th century, broadly construed, there are two general senses and two general narratives that come to the fore. One is nationalism. And the kind of the basis of and what becomes an ethnic nationalism in most places, whereas France has a civic nationalism more like we do. Other places, ethnic nationalism emerges. Our story is the story, and it's certainly still intertwined with religion. Our story is the story of our bloodline. We were wronged in the past. We should be the greatest. We would be the greatest if it weren't for those other people who have come here and taken things from us and robbed us and done us wrong. So in order to become great again, which we all are, because we know it, we've got a story that tells it. In order to become great again, you need to support me and we need to get rid of all those who have come in here and done us wrong. You can see that's a logical conclusion in Nazism, right? The other story is a story that the changes in life and the suffering that comes in the 19th century actually comes from, not from nations, right? Not from blood. It comes from different economic classes that are created by the new world of capitalism. That we are suffering because one person is making a ton of money and we are all just fodder. We don't even have our land anymore. At least we used to get to live on the land when there was a landlord. We're totally free of everything. So all we have left to sell is our labor power. We are wage workers. And that's vital. And that's our form of production. And one of the things I think when it comes to looking at this, the reason that Marx is so, I think, so poignant is because his narrative is, in a lot of ways, the story he tells about the process of what it's like to go through with this. He's really one of the first people to excavate, not just like, here's the economics of it, but like, what's happening down to a very small level. And he talks about some things that I remember reading this and being kind of like, wow, I never thought about it this hard. One of them is the relationship that one has to one's own work and how it changes under an industrial system. So for most people, since the origins of humanity, they had a direct relationship to the things they needed, to their subsistence. So they would go and they would gather, or then they would go and they would farm. The point is, they directly provided for themselves. What happens under capitalism is that a person ceases to have any direct relationship to the thing they produce. They don't grow their food. They don't make their own wares anymore. They now go and they work, and they play one small part along a conveyor belt. They don't own what they produce. So now they get money instead. And the money then allows them to get what they need to survive. But this totally divorces human beings from the work that they do and the product of their work. And this, if you think about it, when you make something with your hands, don't you feel good?
Absolutely.
That's something in humanity. That was what we did as human beings for most of human existence. Capitalism changes that. And that's why, to me, it's such a, so many points in this that are so profound. And certainly if you're thinking from the perspective of a 19th century person living in London.
Hi, everyone. 2018 saw tremendous growth in the cannabis industry in the United States as well as around the world. Kush Company Holdings is leading the way. It's a publicly traded company under the ticker KSHB and the parent to innovative cannabis industry leaders such as Kush Supply Company, Kush Energy, The Hybrid Creative, and Coletto Packaging Solutions. Kush Company Holdings has now sold more than 1 billion units and sells to more than 5,000 legally operated medical and adult use dispensaries, growers, and producers across North America, South America, and Europe. For more information about Kush Company Holdings, please visit kushco.com/podcast. That's kushco.com/podcast. That's kushco.com/podcast to learn more. Ben, what if I worked at a shoe factory?
Aha. This is to prove my point. And actually to prove my point that I was thinking about this. I think it both proves and disproves what Mark said. So here we go. Bob.
Yes.
And everyone listening, you can take a second and think about this. You work in a shoe factory. And this morning, you came out and guess what? There's a new machine in the shoe factory. The machine in the shoe factory doubles the output. In other words, you can now make twice as many shoes in the same amount of time as before. Bob, what are the ways that you think, and everyone listening, just think about this for a second to prove this point, or to make a point that I hope works. What are all the ways that you think your life and the factory itself might change because of this change in productive capabilities?
Well, I think two things come to mind immediately. I would think that a third to half of the employees may lose their jobs.
Yeah.
Or the factory begins to make more money because of the production, and people get raises, or they begin to make different styles of shoes. They expand production. Maybe people don't lose their jobs, but maybe the company will use the efficiency to make different kinds of shoes. Or maybe every shoe factory gets this machine, and then you have a oversupply of shoes. Therefore, the cost of shoes goes down, and therefore people lose their jobs.
Right. Those are all great, because the question was, what are all the possible ways, right? I do this exercise in my class with my students. And, you know, a lot of them give the things that you say. Some people talk about, well, you'll need skilled workers now to work on the machines. Some people talk about supply chain management. One student this semester, for the first time, and I can't believe nobody ever said this, I said, any possible outcome. The student said, the machine becomes sentient and kills all the workers. That was within the bounds of the possible answers, right? But here's what almost no one ever says, Bob. Almost no one ever says, cool, now we have to work half days.
Because we all are trained to think about more.
Yes, because, Bob, we grew up in a particular economic world. And in the economic world, since the time we were born, we were taught that if you can make more, you do make more. In other words, this is what I think makes Marx's point, our ability to imagine is so bound. Because if you ask anybody, how many of you would like to work half as much and earn the same amount? Everyone will say yes. But when it comes down to possibilities of what happens when this machine gets installed, almost no one can contemplate the idea that that is a possible outcome of a machine that doubles your output. So what does that say? It justifies what Mark said, right? That that our ability to imagine and our relationships and our thoughts shaped by the economic environment. But here's why I think it might actually disprove it. Because, Bob, I'm asking students at MTSU this, right? They are not from the capitalist class by and large. And here's the thing. When I ask them what are the possibilities, they think like capitalists. They think like the wealthy bankers. Isn't that nuts?
I think because there's an aspiration, right? I mean, this is what it's all about, the American dream. You make enough to buy a house and to put it in like Richard Rohr, who's a Franciscan monk who's writes a lot of great books. The idea of Falling Upward, the idea that you have the first half of life and the second half of life. And in the first half of life, it's all about acquiring and amassing and being all you can be and succeeding and buying the car and having the house. And, you know, that's how we think. What Marx doesn't address and what we don't address as a society is the second half of life is all about giving it away and getting ready to die because we're human.
Yeah, well, okay, giving it away. Okay, I was thinking more. Like, I think you're
meaning giving it away, either literally giving it away or letting go of the ego and the things that drive us to do the things that we do when we're young.
I think that appeals to a certain economic audience, just in terms of. Because to assume that everyone's planning to give things away assumes that people work the first half of their life and have anything.
I don't think that there's an assumption there. I think it's a spiritual way of looking at the life cycle of a human.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of like thinking outside of economic bounds, giving it away, passing it on, right?
Which you've learned. See, this is why a Marxist can't understand religion. They can't conceive of it. That's ridiculous. You know?
No, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think, first of all, that they would understand religion as, and the way it's interpreted, as a function of the economic world in which people live, right? And that a lot of, look at what happens to Protestant Christianity in the 1890s, right? I mean, you certainly have some critiques of this, but some of the most well-known voices within Christianity in those years are people essentially telling folks the gospel of wealth, right? Kind of the story that's like, you're where you need to be. You're where God wants you to be. If you worked harder, you get better. So in that sense, there is definitely an economic line within that strain, right? Now, the problem is that I neither one of us at all agree with Marx's dismissal of religion. So that's going to be something that we stick on, but at the same time, yeah, it's a problem of it. But he would say that the way you understand your faith is a function of the economic world you live in. So if you look at like the book of Acts and look at what they're doing at the time, what do they do? What's the order? Sell all you have and give it to the church, right?
Right.
Okay. So that's essentially the commandment of the early apostles. And that's why the book of Acts is like my favorite book in the Bible, because everybody's all in and it's beautiful and everyone's helping each other. And it's amazing, right? And then of course everyone comes after them, right?
Right.
So, like, you look at that, but we don't see that. And look at the different ways that things are interpreted, right? You know, the verse from the Bible. And I don't know all of the like intricacies of its interpretation. I've heard different ones, but if you talk to some people, the story that Jesus says it's easier for a camel to fit through the eye of a needle than it is for a wealthy man to get into heaven, right?
Correct.
That has been used different ways. I've heard people say, no, the eye of a needle was an entryway into the city.
Yes, I've heard that as well.
You could only have so much. You could have a lot, but you could only have so much before you get in there. Tell me that isn't an interpretation that's meant to suit the particular world in which acquisition and accumulation of wealth without working for it is justified.
Right. The way I look at it is that we're talking about material gain. We're talking about wealth. When you die, you die alone, right? You die alone. No one goes with you, right? Even if you die in a situation where multiple people die at the same time, they're not going with you, right? And as far as we know, and you can't take your Under Armour workout clothes with you when you go, or your Zoom, whatever this is, recorder, or your Apple Watch, it doesn't go with you.
Right.
So it doesn't matter. Material possessions at some point in your life cease to have, you can indulge them and enjoy them your whole life if you're fortunate enough to have the means to purchase them. But you're not going to Marxism, the idea that life is all about is built upon a material superstructure, right, is only for the time, the dash, right? You have your birth date, you have your death date. There's a dash. That's your life. Your life is the dash. And it's only a valuable theory during the dash, right? So if you're looking for meaning in life beyond an Apple Watch or a Zoom or a Under Armour workout clothes, Marxism does not suit your worldview.
I don't agree with you totally, but you actually demonstrate a really important point. you were thinking about this as a person who is alive in 2018. You were thinking about this as someone who assumes that a person who is working to accumulate something more than the basic needs they have to stay alive. In Marx's time, if you look at what life was like in factories in Great Britain in the 19th century, you were working for just enough to keep yourself alive. So people said, well, these people are working. You know what? They got enough to live off of. They're fine. They came in off the, they came off being peasants, and they've come in here and they're working, and they will work their entire life. And if they stop working, they will starve to death. And by the way, their entire life is not long at this point in time because there's no basic structure, no basic social supports for them at all, right? So, you know, the response that I have to the fact that you're like, we spend the second half of life thinking about how to pass it on, that's because we've actually benefited.
And wait, let me be clear. I don't mean pass it on, but right. I mean, I'm not saying Richard Rohr didn't write this book, Falling Upward, to say what we do. He's writing this book to say, maybe we need to change the way we think about the second half of life or how we prepare for our ultimate decline.
Huh.
Right?
Right.
So he's not saying pass on your material possessions. He's saying change the way you see the world to make aging, decline, and your own passing more joyful.
Yeah.
Not as lonely.
Right.
When you're in a situation where people don't come visit you anymore. You know what I'm saying? And when we all get to that point. And my grandmother lived to be 95. In the last year or two of her life, I had a conversation with her and she was like, I'm the last one left. I'm thinking, no, you're not. I'm here. Where are the people, you know? But her point was, of my peers and contemporaries, I'm the last one. It's kind of lonely, you know, and it doesn't matter that you'll have, hopefully, you know, Solomon won't totally hate you and he'll come around and maybe he'll have a family and you'll have grandkids. But if we all live that long, there will be an isolation that occurs. And so there's a mental preparation that we should maybe, a spiritual journey maybe we need to go on that not only materially prepares us to go, but also spiritually and mentally and the ego, the kind of the shrinking of the ego and that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm saying. Like when we say that our life, I concede, yes, our life is somehow controlled by capitalism and the economy. Right. Because if you have no money, life is hard. And that's wrong. And I hope it can get better, you know, and I hope, you know, we can't agree in this country on what would make it better. Would government funded services make it better, or would reducing taxes and allowing entrepreneurial activity to flourish, would that make it better? We as a nation can't agree. We never will be able to agree, by the way. So I'm talking about the idea of seeing life through a more of a Christian worldview than a Marxist worldview.
Right. But I guess what I'm trying to point out here is that you know
what I like about this historical methods textbook?
What?
Is you read a whole chapter about social theories, you get to the end, and the author concedes, some historians think social theories are bunk. and seeing history through particular methodologies is a waste of time.
See, but here's the thing. To only look at it, right? To only look at it through one, I think, is the problem. Not to combine them and see what we can get out of them. And the thing that's useful about Marx, right, is that, all right, let's say you just pointed out, right, the divisions that we have within the way that people think about the way we should go about things. What Marx would say is, why are you guys fighting with each other? Like, look at it. There's people who are working, who are going to work, whether they got to work two or three jobs, whatever they got. There are people that spend their days and have to spend their lives working, right? In other words, doing something for someone else to acquire money, right? And then there are other people whose livelihoods are made off of just having money, right? Then I've got $1 million in the bank and I can find 5% interest on it. I make $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
Right? If I had $1.5 million in the bank, I would make annually about as much as I make now just because I had that. And that is a fundamental difference. And so the question becomes, why is it that people, working people, don't understand that they actually have everything to gain from essentially changing the system? Because to Marx, capital is money that is in motion. Capital is money that is spent to make more money. And when a person who does not work makes money, in other words, then that money is a share of the production. What that means is that there are a group of people who are not working but are getting paid. And the question should be, for Marx, right? Once again, I argue other people's positions adamantly, like, so nobody think that I'm going on a Workers of the World Unite moment right now. But for Marx, the question would be, why are we okay with the idea that we would go to work every day and that then we would be fleeced of a portion of what we've earned and be okay with that? And then so this, a lot of the history, and the one you read, Wages of Whiteness, is one of them, ask the question, how is it that in spite of having this thing in common, we don't recognize it? And for him, he's looking, I read the reviews of it. I started to read this book and I almost couldn't put it down. I had to stop because we had to do this interview.
Wages of Whiteness?
Right, yeah.
I don't know what his deal is, but I wouldn't mind trying to get him on if he's alive. I don't even know if he's alive.
Well, if he is and listening right now, shout out. We'd love to have you on.
But Rediger, if you are alive.
Right, but the point is, like, he's saying, okay, look, at the end of the day, white folks and black folks in the South, after the Civil War, are all broke. Almost all of them. They're impoverished. So, like, what is in it? Why don't they all identify with the fact that there's, like, a very small group of people that own everything, that exploit the hell out of them, and that make their money off of them working?
Because we decided that you're poor and you're white, but hey, you have a benefit because you're white.
Right. So don't worry. It's better for you. And you don't want those black folks thinking that they could have it as good as you, because if they do, they'll be taking something away from you.
And language plays such a role in shaping the white working class. What we know today as the white working class, the advent of language and the changing of language, changing from the term master to boss.
Right.
But these little linguistic turns in our culture shaped the whole concept of what it meant to be a white worker, a white wage worker.
Right. And this is largely, I think, what makes his work, neo-Marxist, right? Because it incorporates other fields of study, right? But the simple fact that the category of analysis is the working class, right? That's not something that is inherent in the way we think about things. Right. If you look at history before Marx's theory, a lot of it has to do with, if you look at a history of the American Revolution early on, it's like the leaders were there. They were inspired by something greater. These leaders did everything. You start going, that's strange. So like these people are divinely inspired, or everything that's good that ever happened came because of like six people.
So is that top down?
Yes. And that's.
And so Marxist is bottom up.
Right. So you ask yourself, like, what are the people actually doing? How does something, so you look, two different ways to look at the American Revolution. One was Thomas Jefferson was like, this ain't cool. We got the Enlightenment. And then all the other, like the people at the Declaration of Independence, they signed it and they were like, that's right. Our freedom. That's one way to think about it. Another way to think about it is that, the workers and, the people that are farming and the people that are working in shops are all getting screwed over because of the British tariff system. And they can't even turn their raw goods into product because the British Empire requires them to sell it back to England and then buy it back after it's been manufactured, and they're paying for the transportation costs. And that's an economic understanding of why particular classes are angry. But this is, I think, so this is why I think it's like crucial, because
this is a good example, and please hold your thought. That is a Marxist view, a Marxist method, applying a Marxist theory to the American Revolution, which some people would think would be odd to do, but it's not at all, because that's a separation between the Soviet Union, between Stalin, between the revolution and Stalin, and Marxism as a form of historical analysis.
Right. And it's actually the most valuable, I think, when you look at the Constitution. because, you know, we are brought up like, oh, the founders gave us this constitution and look at the rights that are secured. Oh, this was a blessing of liberty. And don't get me wrong. I'm a big lover of the Constitution. Big lover. Like, still crazy that people would have power and then put limits on them. That's cool. But you have to ask yourself, why did they, you know, like, Articles of Confederation was failing. What motivates them to write it? And you can look at the documents from the and the discussions that go down at the Constitutional Convention. What are their motivations? One, they can't pay their debt. And two, these new citizens, the former soldiers who fought them, are rising up against the governments, particularly Shays' Rebellion. And that, friends, like, if you look at that, that is a class-based notion of struggle between the people in Boston, the bankers, the early investors in all of this, the people who are involved in finance, and the farmers who make the money. And you can read, like, some of the accounts of what they're saying. They're saying, you know, basically, we've been taxed to death, had all of our stuff taken, and you know what? We're all doing it because the people in the city are taxing the hell out of us to pay off the debt. And you know what they're doing? They're taxing us to pay off the colony's debt. Well, guess who owns a bunch of the debt? As it turns out, the rich people in Boston. So they've made a decision, and this is what they say in Shays' Rebellion. They made a decision, essentially, and this is 1786, 1787, right as they're about to go write the Constitution. What they're saying is, okay, like, this is all for the benefit of a certain group of people who don't do the work. And you can see that there. And from that perspective, the Constitution looks like, and I think is, a document that ensures the right to private property and that it can't be taken, and also provides the means to raise an army to put down the people that might be trying to take away your property as well. So these are two different ways of looking at it. Now, is one perfectly right? No, this is the thing. They both tell different stories, and there are a variety of different ways to look at it. But if you don't understand that other part, then you look at American history as some divinely ordained story, and you don't understand that, like, the Constitution is partially a response to a class-based uprising against the leaders of early America.
Well, this has just been a delightful conversation.
Yes. And for those of you who don't get that, like, why do we throw into this? Our patrons will know, because this is part of Bob being in grad school and me wishing that I could be in his methodology class. And our last Patreon episode from last week, we talked about narratives and history and power. And we just decided to share this one with you because this is what me and Bob have been doing lately. I love it. And I think it makes Bob even more frustrated. Also, before we go, shout out to Gordon Lee for sitting down last night at Smokers Abbey in Nashville and just talking with me about this, or more likely, letting me talk it all out at him because he's my friend. He sat down and listened to it. So shout out to Gordon. One last disclaimer. I am in no way an advocate of any systems that have been established based upon Marxism. I am in no way arguing that Marxism is the truth. I am in no way, shape, or form saying you should become a Marxist. What I am doing is learning about things, trying to explain them, trying to explain why people found them useful at one point in time, trying to explain why they might still be useful now. It is not a revolutionary ideology. It is simply an explanation of something I've read and at times found to be useful in understanding the world. There you go.
Ben is a Marxist and he wants to plow your kids full of candy and keep them up all night long. So watch out.
Children of the world, unite.
That's right.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now was hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. And today's music, like pretty much always, is by the wonderful Paul DeFiglia. As always, also, we'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCane, Peggy Donica, and the newest one, Susan Sharp. If you'd like to support us and what we do, you can do that on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. We're working on some pretty cool stuff over there, so I'm excited to share that with y'all. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and does a lot to help us spread the word.
Osiris.